Hello and welcome to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I am Maria Demertis, the Deputy Director of Bruegel, and today I'm presenting a latest episode of the Director's Cut series, focusing on a new book that our guest has written. Our guest today is Yair Listokin, who is the Shimbley Family Fund Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Yair, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Yair, you have recently written a book which we don't often see in the context of economics, entitled Law and Macroeconomics. That in itself is a very interesting topic. Why don't you walk us through the main motivation behind writing this paper and what your main messages are?
So the main messages of the book are two. First, I want to use law, and I argue that law is a potential tool of macroeconomic policy, and it's one that hasn't been explored very much, and we need to do that in light of the limitations of fiscal and monetary policy. That's one. The second part of the book is to understand that law also plays a critical role in the making of monetary and fiscal policy. And not enough attention has been paid to the legal aspects of particularly monetary policy, but also fiscal as well. And that looking at these policies with a legal lens, we can see things that we might not have seen otherwise.
And were you motivated by the financial crisis? Is this what motivated you to look at this issue, or is this a broader and more widely relevant issue?
I think it is more widely relevant, but it became much more urgent in response to the financial crisis.
And you say that, law is a tool that can be used for macroeconomics. You know, we tend, economists, and I mean, I don't speak for all economists, but from an economic lens, we tend to think of law as a something that is engraved, and it's even cultural, I would say, and something that doesn't, of course it changes, but it doesn't change as a tool in response to shocks, at least not as in real time as macroeconomic tools change. And here we talk about the business cycle versus the structure of the economy. Structure is about providing incentives, and there the law has a very clear role to play. But macroeconomic tools are about responding to the shocks, always within the limits of the law, but in real time, which law cannot necessarily do. Is that a distinction that is helpful here, and how do you see that?
Potentially. I come from the law and economics tradition, and we very much, and this is typically a law and microeconomics tradition, but this tradition is very much that law is not just sort of something sent from God, that it evolves, that it is a tool of policy. Richard Posner famously argued that there almost is no such thing as law. It's only policy. I certainly would not go that far. But just so you know, it's out there. And part of the motivation here is that, so the argument in law and microeconomics is that where the law is unclear, it should evolve towards microeconomic efficiency. And I want to amend that to argue that it's not just microeconomic efficiency, also macroeconomics matters a lot. And that having laws that are, and judges and regulators that are not macroeconomically informed can cause a real problem.
That's certainly true, and I certainly see, and there's many examples that we can use from the crisis where had judges been slightly more informed about economic implications of certain decisions, and indeed if economists were able to draw on law interpretations, things would have moved forward. But I still like to sort of come back to this distinction between what can we do in real time, which is very much how we think about a macroeconomic policy, and how can the law help in the context of the real time? I don't know if you have any examples you can use that can inform our...
So I'll give an example from contract law in the U.S. that I think kind of represents what I'm thinking about. In the U.S., in the TARP program, which bailed out the large financial institutions, it included about $60 billion for mortgage relief. Now it's 10 or 11 years later, a lot of the money hasn't been spent. That's very unusual. Why? Why has that money not been spent? What makes it even stranger is that a lot of the owners of that debt, the creditors, many of them hedge funds, are on record as saying they wish they could write down some of the debt. So what has happened? We have, certainly the debtors would like to have mortgage write-downs. The creditors would like to have mortgage write-downs. And of course, the government has money. Somehow the money's not being spent. Why not? One critical impediment here that has prevented the money from being spent is law. The contracts that govern these debts are managed by mortgage servicers. And those contracts had a particular purpose involved. And that purpose was the creditors before the crisis were very afraid that the servicers would be too lenient in writing down mortgages. So that to prevent moral hazard, they wrote contracts that made it very, very hard as a matter of contract law to renegotiate any mortgages, no matter how much the creditor wanted it or whatever. And ultimately, in the crisis, this became a problem. Because even though everyone wanted the mortgage renegotiated or written down with the government helping, the contract law got in the way. And I argue that contract law is more flexible than that, that there's a doctrine called public policy limitations, that if certain contracts are getting in the way of sort of broader policy implications, we don't want to do this too often, but in certain contexts where like everyone wants to change the contract, we should allow this to go forward. A judge should say these provisions were not intended for this purpose, and interpreting the contract broadly, we actually will allow a write down.
So this is a very clear example where the inflexibility of the law actually prevented good macroeconomic outcomes from arising, right? But we're still in the context of dealing with a crisis. This is a very big problem because it's a systemic problem. There's a lot of bad debts that need to be written down. And macroeconomics is interested in this particular occasion because it has got huge macroeconomic implications in terms of aggregate demand. So there is really an effort from the macroeconomy to try and affect the law to change in order to get better outcomes in real time. But again, how can we use a law to manage problems as they arise? One of the issues that I have in mind is that the stability of the law, the predictability of the law, is crucial for the business environment, is crucial for investments. So you need to know what kind of contracts you get into before you get into. And here, the certainty of the law and the stability of the law, I think, plays a big role in providing macroeconomic outcomes. Now, if you are now going to use the law as a tool which changes and spans, you know, shorter than potential contracts, this could be quite distortionary, don't you agree?
Well, it depends. And it depends, of course it depends. But it depends on, I see it as, if a policy is articulated in advance, then it is not necessarily more uncertain than a policy than a law that just never changes.
Yeah, indeed.
So the argument would be that so long as the environment is stated that law might be different in a crisis than it would be at some other time, then that becomes part of the business environment and people may understand and therefore not view it as unlawful if the law does in fact change, because it's just part of the macroeconomic environment is just one of many considerations that courts or regulators or whoever will consider when they make a policy.
So there is a golden middle way that allows for flexibility but stability on the other hand, right? And
yes,
we need to exploit that, you're saying. If I may, in your book, you also talk about the European Central Bank, and I think that's kind of an interesting example. If you could walk us through your thoughts on the way that the European Central Bank used its power to extend the limits, to interpret its limits, and even challenge the law sometimes.
Yes. So when we think about the European Central Bank, of course, its mandate is more limited than it is in the United States. And it also, however, it plays an enormous economic policy-making role, especially given the lack of fiscal transfers between EU nation states. There are some, but nowhere on the scale of the United States. So we have big responsibilities, and and limited a limited mandate. And with the OMT program, the ECB and Mario Draghi in particular said he will do whatever it takes within his mandate to respond to the euro crisis. And what that meant, famously, it was a subject of litigation, the ultimate policy that came out of that, was at a minimum a very, very aggressive interpretation of the ECB's mandate. I think that it is a legitimate interpretation, but a legitimate expansive interpretation of that law. And indeed, it's exactly the type of thing that I would encourage to happen more broadly, where sort of people who are interpreting law, I see Draghi and the ECB as a type of regulator, and they are understanding their responsibilities broadly in light of the macroeconomic environment. Now, I do think, and with this, I will. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to say who's right and who's wrong, but I do think it behooves the ECB to be a little more explicit in defining like what their principles are when they're understanding the legal limit. Where does it end? That doesn't mean they have to give long legal discourses. They don't need to give like formal legal opinions. But just when people want to know that the European Central Bank is very aware of its limits, then when announcing a policy that pushes against those limits, I think it's important that they articulate sort of, all right, we're doing this. We know it's difficult, but here's why we think it's okay, and here's where we'll draw the line.
But admittedly, the example that you give of OMT was very much a reaction to a very big shock, a very unpredictable shock. So, you know, when you are effectively walking in the dark, you are going to be a bit cautious in terms of how you speak, simply because you don't know where you're going. And that is not necessarily an unreasonable policy, right? But what you're saying is that you're using the law, just explain it better. That's what you're saying. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes. With central banks, that's exactly what I hope for. Just as they've become incredibly transparent about their understanding of the economy, I would argue, and I'm doing that with some co-authors in a future paper, that something along those lines, it would be a good idea on the legal side.
Yeah. But can I bring you back to this issue of the structure versus the business cycle? Because I think that's also a very important thing to try and understand how we can use the law differently than we do now to promote good economic outcomes. Now, I don't disagree with you that on the design of the law, we can make sure that we have good countercyclical policies. I think that is something that is very prominent in your book, and I think it's an important thing. But that's on the design of the law, which happens once and happens only periodically. It doesn't happen in real time. Can we go a little bit more frequent on that and still use changes in the law, interpretations in the law, and under what framework without necessarily jeopardizing the very important thing of the law, which is stability?
So I think yes, and I think the idea is it's actually analogous to the contract law interpretation that I was talking about before, that it's very important for judges and regulators to understand how their behavior fits into the system. And that doesn't mean that it's the only thing that matters, but it does mean that it's a consideration. So if certain things are, it's not the only consideration, but judges and regulators, especially regulators, often have a good deal of discretion. And my argument would be that they can use some of that discretion in a macroeconomically informed manner. That doesn't mean that they can do whatever they want. There are going to be limits. They cannot exceed those limits. But so long as they operate within those limits, it is legitimate to introduce a macroeconomic consideration, one among many, in interpreting that discretion along one or another.
In Europe, we have the added difficulty that we don't have one legal framework. We have many legal frameworks, and every country, of course, deals with its own problems and in its own legal framework. Some of them can go up to the European level, but a number of things have to be dealt at the local, at the national legal framework. And I'm going, I go back to this issue of the bankruptcy simply because it was one of the biggest issues, and in fact, dare I say, still remains in the EU, where we had a very big component of non-performing loans following the crisis. And those countries that, you know, reform the systems, legally reform the systems, are the ones who actually managed to deal with it. Those who are lagging behind are still lagging behind also in the solutions to the problem. It's not obvious what is best practice, though. And you know, if you don't know what best practice is in terms of what is the best thing one could do in the legal sense, it's very difficult to recommend also a change. Is it better to try and be very lenient when it comes down to sort of, you know, bankruptcy law because it helps with creative destruction? Or is it better to be slightly more predictable but very firm when it comes to sort of the type of the contracts that you have in order to ensure that, you know, investments and credit does happen? The literature is not decided there. What is your view on that?
My view is, again, and I think there are limits. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, a bankruptcy judge can do whatever they want. But I think that in every, certainly in the US, which I know the best, their bankruptcy judges are often decide cases on basis of standards like undue hardship. So there's a lot of room there to interpret things according to any one of a number of criteria, one of which might be macroeconomic considerations. Bankruptcy law sometimes considers what would happen in the community and things like that. So there are some places within bankruptcy law, let's say, contract law less so, although as we talked about before, even with public policy limitations, even in contract. So there's some room. The amount of room will differ by countries. In some countries, without a comprehensive legal reform, there won't be much room. And that's okay. But there will always be some room. And my argument would be that, you know, we should use what is available and consider expanding the amount of room available.
Yeah. If I may ask one last question, and in your book you use the word the zero lower bound very often, and I think that recognizes that monetary policy, certainly in Europe, less so in the US, but more so in Europe, monetary policy is very much restricted in its conventional tools, and you know, central banks have been quite imaginative in the way that they thought of tools to try and deal with the once-in-a-lifetime crisis. But the fact of the matter is that we will probably be in that zero lower bound for some time to come, meaning that the scope for conventional policies is very small. The central banks have been asked to think about innovative solutions, some have been materialized, and they still are thinking about innovative solutions that inevitably push their jurisdiction, as far as the law is concerned. If you were to suggest one thing that central banks can do in that context, while we're dealing with a rather limited fiscal policy because of the high fiscal debts and a very limited monetary policy, certainly the conventional side, is there one suggestion that you could provide us that we can sort of work on in terms of how could you stimulate aggregate demand as we're about to enter in the next recession?
So this is for central banks?
Yes, for central banks.
Only for central banks. So with central banks, first of all, I think that the macroprudential policies that have already started to have become de rigueur are excellent, and we may even consider ramping them up. That this is especially at the zero lower bound, you're sort of out of conventional ammo, and I actually think that even unconventional bond buying programs should have some limit, but these macroprudential regulations, like leverage limitations, are sort of an alternative means of adjusting business cycles that are certainly now legitimate. We can kind of understand how they work, and they have the potential to do a lot for the business cycle. They're within the ambit of the central bank, and the central bank has the expertise to use them.
Well, actually, in the euro area, at least, the macroprudentials are not necessarily with the central bank. They are again, mm-hmm. in typical European fashion, they're in different institutions, coordinated institutions, typically by central banks, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And of course, they also need to be aggregated at the euro area level. But I think this is a very good message to finish with. The macroprudential, the design of macroprudential tools and the a lot more actual use of macroprudential tools as a new way of helping monetary policy achieve some of its main and secondary objectives. With that, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Listhokin, for joining us today. This brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening to the Director's Cut of The Sound of Economics, and thank you again for joining us. If you're interested in more of Bruegel's work, we have an array of blog posts and publications available at our website, www.bruegel.org. Thank you very much. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.